and guest who's going to talk a little bit about the guiding life, since he's been involved in it for the majority of his employable days. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes. My name is Neil Brown, and I'm a guide. Recently retired guide, that is, but for most of my professional adult life, I have made a living guiding people around the rivers and lakes and mountains of British Columbia.
And what job did you most recently retire from?
I was a helicopter skiing guide for a company called Whistler Heliskiing in the town I live in, which was a great job because I got paid to go skiing powder every day, and I got to sleep in my own bed at night.
How many years were you with Whistler Heliski?
It was just over 30 years. So I have skied a disproportionate amount of powder in my life, more than any one person deserves to, perhaps. But it's not just all fun and games and getting paid to go skiing. There's a colossal amount of responsibility associated with guiding in the mountains anywhere in the world, and there's a lot of work to get there becoming a guide.
So what was your position? Were you lead guide, tail guide?
Yeah, I was I started out as a guide and worked my way up to being a lead guide, mm-hmm. Which is a higher level of certification, but I think you kind of touched on the fact that there is the opportunity to get into guiding as an assistant guide or a tail guide in the case of heli skiing or cat skiing. So basically there are three levels in helicopter skiing. Anyway, you're either a tail guide, which is an assistant guide, or a guide who can work under the direction of a lead guide or a lead guide.
Gotcha. And did Whistler Heliski help you progress in that respect? You said you needed a higher level of certification. Is that something you...
Yeah. To a certain degree, they did. Whistler being the international destination that it is, there are other skill sets that they were looking for as well. One of them being to have a second language. So most of the guides there do speak more than one language. And in my case, it was Japanese that I had, and when I first started guiding with that company, we did have quite a few clients coming from Japan. Their economy was booming at the time, and so that was beneficial for me, and Whistler Heliskiing's upper management recognized that, the owners recognized it, and helped facilitate my working towards becoming a lead guide.
Incredible. What certification agency helped you get that?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to become a heli skiing guide. You can either belong to the Canadian Ski Guide Association or the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides. Guides in the mechanized industry, as it's called in British Columbia, which is cat skiing and heli skiing. I think it's a pretty even mix of CSGA and ACMG. Guides. Many of the owners of outfits have only gone through the CSGA route, which specializes a little bit more in just the mechanized form of guiding and not so much the uphill, although that is a major component of any guiding in the mountains. And if you go the ACMG route and become a full-fledged mountain guide, then you are also then automatically a member of the International Association of Mountain Guides, which is about 26 countries, I think. It fluctuates a little bit from year to year, but 26 countries recognize the associations that other countries have regarding guiding in the mountains. And so if I am a full mountain guide with the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, then I can go to any one of those other countries and they accept my certification as being valuable enough for me to just work in that country.
Right.
Show the ticket and you've got a job in France or Italy or
That's
Switzerland
cool.
or any of the mountain countries.
And from what I know about ACMG, there's a couple different facets to it. There's like the ski guide, rock guide, and mm-hmm. and alpine guide. Is that
yeah right? And you have to have all three of those to become a mountain guide,
right?
So there's components that you get along the way, and each one of them takes years to get, probably 5 years on average if you're pursuing it diligently to become a full-fledged mountain guide. You have to be keen and spend lots of time in the mountains. And it's not like 5 years of university where you're there every day, but you do have to document the mountains you climbed and who was in your party and what you've done, and then take your exams for, as you said, rock climbing, mm-hmm. and then there's another exam for alpine guides. It involves more ice climbing and glacier travel, and once you've got all of those certifications that the ACMG offers in place, then you become a mountain guide, and an internationally certified mountain guide.
Wow. So that's a whole other route to take that leads you to a career in a lot of places in the world.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Somebody from Japan or France or Austria can come to Whistler, where I live, and show their certification as a mountain guide and get a job as a heli ski guide here in Whistler. Right.
So do you have your ACMG ski guide?
No, I went through the CSGA.
Okay, right. So you didn't dabble in that ACMG at all?
Yeah, and about half the people on the core team of 7 or 8 guides at Whistler Heli Skiing are mountain guides. Well, not even half. There's only probably 2 or 3 of them that are full-fledged mountain guides, and the rest have just gone with the ski guide route.
Right. Sounds like you could be overqualified for a lot of jobs if you end up being a mountain guide.
I mean, yeah, certainly you could. You're overqualified to be a hiking guide or just a rock guide because mm-hmm. you've got experience that's vastly beyond that. But for mountain guide, I mean, mountain guides get killed every year, so I wouldn't call those guys overqualified. It's right. Experience is a huge factor. Somebody who's just recently become a mountain guide may not be as proficient in the hills as somebody who's been a ski guide for 20 years.
Right. When you were taking your CSGA, did you have to lead a trip at any point?
You do, yeah. On your exams, you're leading examiners, so, you know, you're with the president of the ACMG and other very experienced dignitaries such as that, and so there's a lot of pressure on you right there, but part of it is being able to deal with the stress and you know, there's being quotes that part of being a good guide is to not show fear even when you're experiencing it, so you have to kind of be trained in that and how to stay calm in the more hazardous, dangerous, exciting a situation becomes. The calmer you have to become, it kind of helps with dealing with whatever the situation is.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an experience at work where that skill was handy?
Yeah, there are many of those. You know, again, if you spend enough time in the hills, you're going to deal with fatalities, and I've seen my share of those. But the training that I received along the way to becoming a guide was extremely beneficial in helping me deal with those situations.
Right. And if we're talking about an average day in the life of a heli ski guide, what did that look like when you were working for Whistler Heli Ski?
Yeah, I was there a long time, so it kind of evolved over the decades, but it's a pretty early start in the morning. There are a lot of resources available for checking the weather, which mm-hmm. is one of the most important things you need to know when you're flying a helicopter around in the mountains in the wintertime. And then for the guiding aspect, knowing which way the wind blew and how much precipitation happened overnight. So a typical guide's up around 5:30 in the morning, and by 6:30 they've had a coffee and a little bite to eat, and they have a pretty good idea of what the weather that day is going to be like because of all the great resources available to them, but it does take time to sift through them all. And then it's off to a morning meeting, 6:30. Recently that's been kind of a conference call to make the decision as to whether you're going to fly or not, because some days you just realize it's too hazardous to go into the mountains, whether that's for the flying conditions or the avalanche hazard. And if you decide you're moving forward at 6:30, then there's a physical meeting where all the guides are present in a room with the pilots, preferably, and the tail guides, and any camera people or film, anybody that's going to be out there that day other than the actual clients. And you discuss where you're going to go and how the logistics of the day are going to run. And they can be quite complex. And the bigger helicopter skiing outfits in British Columbia, as many as 8 or 10 helicopters can be flying in a day. Whistler Heliskiing fly up to 5 or 6 helicopters a day. They all take off for different compass points from the central heliport in the morning. So the logistics are a little bit overwhelming sometimes, but once you get into the groove of it day after day after day, it just becomes routine. You get up at 5:30 and you're hoping to be on your skis by 10 o'clock.
All right, and then the guests arrive. What's the first step? Like, what do you guys talk to them? Is it first just trying to get to know them, or is it communicating the kind of dangers that are going to be possible because they already know that they're going to have so much fun?
Yeah, well, every guest has had to sign a pretty comprehensive waiver that's standard in the industry, and that waiver lists many, many of the hazards that you can encounter in the mountains. But generally, when the guide greets a guest for the first time, and it's often not the first time because many guests return to the week-long lodges or even to the day product that Whistler Heliskiing offers, so often we've seen them before, and they kind of get categorized by the office first according to their experience levels and then put into groups with other people that have similar skill sets or ability levels and experience in the mountains, and then off you go with them. But everybody must go through training every day, and that training consists of avalanche transceiver work, practice avalanche rescue drills, what to do in the event of a helicopter emergency, say the helicopter crashes. So that's why getting your skis on by 10 o'clock in the morning is quite a challenge, because after the weather meetings and the regular meetings and meeting the folks and putting them through all the training, it's quite a bit to digest for people first thing in the morning, especially if they've never been heliskiing before. And even if they've been last year, they've often forgotten most of what they learned in terms of the safety and how to deal with an emergency. So yeah, going through that's a huge part of every morning when you get rolling, get started with your day.
By the end of this little avalanche seminar, how much faith do you actually usually have in these clients?
Yeah, I think the experienced guides learn to read people right away. I mean, they're going skiing with you, so when you head to the heliport, which is about 10 minutes away from where we meet them in Whistler, you watch how they hold their skis when they're walking to the bus, and little clues like that that kind of tell you, and the attentiveness level when people are listening to your dissertation on safety. You can identify who's going to be able to help you in a serious situation and who's basically you want to sideline so that they're not getting in your way.
Right. Have you had to call on clients to help you in an emergency situation before?
I think most guides have, because you're on your own with your people once you get in your helicopter and head to where you're going or your snowcat and get out of the machine and start heading down the mountain. It's just you and your group. So if anything happens to you, then it's your group that has to get you out. So your training better get the message across pretty strongly to them so that they know what to do and realize how serious the situation is. Mm-hmm. And if it's one of your folks in your group, then you've got lots of other bodies to help you out. If you have to dig somebody out of an avalanche, it's going to be a lot faster with four people helping you than doing it on your own, obviously. So.
Right. And even after that discussion, how much of the danger do you feel like your clients don't see?
Oh, yeah, they're pretty, they're pretty oblivious to how many ways you can get killed in the mountains. There are lots of ways to get killed in the mountains, and I don't think they recognize even a fraction of them.
Yeah.
But that's part of the job of a guide, too, is to make them feel comfortable, to make them feel as though they're kind of on the edge of something really exciting and dangerous, but without any real threat to themselves. Mm-hmm. And if you're guiding well, then that's the way it should be.
Right. Yeah, I guess part of guiding is the safety aspect, but then there's also being personable and listening to what people's qualms are and whatever else might arise.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an older retired guide now, and so I was a guide for a long time, and when I first started, guides didn't really have to have the interpersonal skills that are required today. You didn't have to have the language skills, although most guides were European way back when I started, so they did have additional languages. But back in those days, you could just hit your client over the head with a ski pole and tell them to smarten up. And nowadays, you have to have more politically correct interpersonal skills, let's say.
That makes sense with the progression of the world and things that are acceptable.
Yeah, I think so.
When you're making those decisions of where to go and what point of the compass to fly to, is that mostly dependent on condition? I guess I'm sure there's a multitude of reasons, but conditions, or is there like intermediate terrain that you're bringing people to, advanced terrain?
Yeah, it starts with trying to go to the best skiing every day.
Right.
And the best skiing is safe skiing as well. But then beyond that, again, good guides will watch their clients on the very first pitch of the mountain that you ski them on and evaluate their comfort level and ability level. And for the rest of the day, adjust accordingly and take them to places where they feel like they're skiing well and skiing comfortably. They're not just beyond the edge of their ability. Although, that being said, me personally, I did like to take people somewhere, or at least once a day during the day, I would scare them a little bit. Maybe by taking them in just a little bit past what their comfort zone is. So break them out of their paradigm, I guess, would be the cliche. Because I recognized early on in my career that at the end of the day, people don't talk about the bunny run that they skied on Whistler or Blackcomb. They talk about that steep line that they crashed and cartwheeled all the way down when they're in the bar having a beer later on that night. So I like to challenge people just at least once a day, take them down something that was maybe just a little bit beyond their ability and see how they did.
That's great. That's an interesting way to think about guiding. That's because when I was working this summer at Strathcona Park Lodge, we had this kind of philosophy of like your, you know, comfort zone and then your growth zone. And then outside of that, there's like a panic zone.
Yes.
I would imagine that it's difficult to keep people in that growth zone when you're in such big terrain and without going into the panic zone.
Yeah, I guess fortunately with ski guiding, whether it's uphill ski touring and or cat skiing, heli skiing, I think you're in the growth zone most of the day for most people because they're outside of what their normal experience is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my experience in the mountains every day out there is just so fantastic regardless of the weather and the conditions. And there's not just the mental challenges and the physical exercise, but the spiritual gain that you get from being out there. So all three of those things, when if you're used to working in an office and suddenly you find you're out for a day of ski touring with a backcountry guide or a day of heli skiing with a heli ski guide, I think you're in the growth circle, as you call it, that whole day.
Yeah, that's great. That's unique for a career that you've done for so long to still be in that zone all the time. But I guess that's what Mother Nature provides. So you've been in the mountains countless times. Can you think of a day at work heli skiing that really sticks with you? Like where that was, when that was, whether it was early on in your career, whether the clients were what made the difference, or whether it was the conditions or pilot choice, whatever it was.
I mean, I literally have thousands of days. So, but to answer your question, yeah, there are a few that stick out. There was, here on the coast, we don't really get the Utah powder that often, but every year you get a couple of days of that super light, bottomless fluff. Usually it's just really nice powder most of the time, but and then every 4 or 5 years, you get an exceptional day where you've got a meter of fluff that's just stable enough to ski steep stuff so that you can get down through it. And you spend most of the day trying to wipe your goggles off as you're skiing, kind of don't quite need a snorkel, but almost. So those days really stand out. And then some of the more tragic days, unfortunately, stick with you too, where you've been involved in rescues and recoveries.
Yeah, those, I can't imagine. I've done, I know, like, my, you know, my fair share of training, but there's nothing like a real situation, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, and you're young, so that'll come to you if you stick with the outdoor pursuits, which it seems you're kind of cut out for to a certain degree. You know, I started my skiing career, getting paid to ski as a professional patroller on Whistler before there even was Blackcomb. And I vividly remember my first couple of very serious injuries and fatalities as a ski patroller. And it's never easy. For some people, it's easier than others. And I think each individual has a different level of tolerance for those events. Some people have had enough after one, and other people can go through 10 and not need any counseling for post-traumatic stress. And others get their back broken, so to speak, on their 32nd serious incident, and that's all they can take. But yeah, I never did max out there, even though I've seen my share. I've been lucky enough to be able to deal with them.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's also something that you don't really know until you're faced with.
Yeah, I think it's kind of in human nature to just want to help others that are in, you know, severe or dire need or distress. And in my case, adrenaline has always kind of helped flush to the forefront the important things to do in those situations. And you're not really concerned about yourself or much else other than helping that person out. I mean, your own safety comes first, because you don't want to dive into some situation where you're now going to be in the same unfortunate boat as them. But once you've established that you're okay to go in and help, then their well-being is your primary, your only focus. So right. I think if you continue your outdoor path, you'll find that, because once again, it does go with the territory. If you're running around in the mountains, there's a lot of ways that you can get swatted out there. Same on the rivers and even on the lakes.
Yeah. Song break. All right, Neil, what song do you have for us today?
I was thinking John Cougar Mellencamp when you asked me for a song. There's so many great ones. I had a hard time deciding, but I think it's called Authority. I fought authority, and authority always wins, and no particular reason other than it's a catchy tune with lyrics that I like.
Small correction here. It's actually called the Authority Song.
All right, here it comes. Thank you.
caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Everyone at VAMS understands the challenges of having a disability in an able-bodied world. Since 1988, the Vancouver Adapted Music Society has supported musicians with disabilities on their journeys. Check out Reimagine Radio on YouTube to learn more about our diverse community. To stay up to date with us, subscribe to the channel and drop a like to show some support.
Okay, let's see here. Blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Hi there. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus, located on the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. While we broadcast from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations, and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca, that is, native-land.ca, to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on, or maybe visiting. Thank you.
Welcome back to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. We pick our chat back up with Neil Brown, professional guide of over 30 years, speaking about the seasonality of guiding and what that means for him.
So, obviously, this is a seasonal job. What do you do in the summer? What have you done in the summer that coincides with guiding?
Yeah. Well, I was a river guide for many years as well. with two other guys, I was an equal partner in a company called Whistler River Ventures, which was the first whitewater rafting company established in Whistler. Back in those days, we didn't make any money, but it was a lifestyle job, and we made enough to feed ourselves and shelter ourselves. And we just loved being outdoors and playing on the rivers every day.
And how long did that go on for?
Oh, that was several years. Eventually, we sold that company, but in the meantime, you know, we ran five rivers in the vicinity of Whistler, and with skills you had as being a professional whitewater rafting guide, you could travel to other places in the world and run other rivers too. So I had the luxury of going down some of the bigger rivers like the Grand Canyon in Colorado. It was a pretty special trip that I would recommend anybody who loves the outdoors do at least once in their life.
Yeah, it's on the bucket list for sure.
Yeah, should be. Talk to anybody who's done it and they'll tell you it's a trip of a lifetime.
So at that point when you did that, were you already guiding for Whistler?
Yeah, we were. It was a bunch of river guys that went down because we went on a private permit, which, again, because they restrict the numbers going down there, to get that private permit, you have to enter a lottery because hundreds of parties are vying for just a few spots every year. And so you put your name in, you pay your $25 or whatever it is today. I'm not sure how much the fee would be. and you take your chances, as they say, and if your name gets drawn, then you can get a permit for up to 21 days on the river and up to 16 people in your party. But you also must have the proof that you have certified rafting guides and trip leaders, on your trip, and that you have all the necessary equipment to for survival should anything go wrong, because you are in true wilderness in America on that trip, which is pretty astounding considering how many people are in the United States and how well roaded it is. This is really impenetrable wilderness right in the heart of the southwestern USA. So it's, once again, a pretty cool trip. Yeah. You're going to do it one day, I think.
I hope so. So it sounds like you have a lot of lived experience. Is that something that you got to share with clients? Like, do you get to, you know, whether you're rafting guests or heli-ski guests, and you get to talk to them kind of about your life, or is it more you're having to ask them about themselves?
Yeah. Well, in my case, I prefer to ask them about themselves and learn about them. It's, you know, you get to entertain people from all around the world who come from many interesting backgrounds and mostly quite successful people. So I think you can learn a lot from them. Right now I'm talking a lot about myself, which makes me a little bit uncomfortable because I prefer talking about other people and their lives, which are very often more interesting than mine. But yeah, I guess, you know, I like people too, which is, I think, an important component of being a good guide these days. You have to truly enjoy the company of others and learning about them. So that made it a bit easier for me.
And I guess when you do get the opportunity to talk a little bit, you have the stage with these successful people. What do you like to share?
Oh, I guess I'll let them prompt me, but, you know...
Is it more nature?
Yeah, well, I read quite a bit too, so, but I try not to get involved with religion or politics. It's more about, you hit on it a little bit there because of my love of the outdoors and the natural world. I try to encourage people to help to conserve it and promote nature itself, and you know, that can lead you into some sticky conversations too if you're taking the president of a car company, for example. Geez, are cars really good for the world? I mean, they're kind of a necessary part of modern society, but you know, we get into some interesting debates and conversations that way sometimes too. I mean, when you're meeting these interesting people from all around the world, you really get into some great discussions. And to me, that was part of guiding that I loved. The après, just like an après ski day, when you go and talk about that hill you tumble down, is a big part of the heli skiing day too. Because most people that are out there, whether it's a river trip or a trip into the mountains, at the end of the day, a nice beverage is always fun to enjoy. And then if you've had a couple of those, recounting your experience of the day and get into some other angles of conversation. Always interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you've been to Japan, right?
Yes, I guess Japanese was the second language that I brought to Whistler Heli Skiing because I did some time there for about 4 years. I traded in my ski suit for a business suit, and I worked as a resort planning consultant was my title. And I was working for a small local company in Whistler that specializes in designing and planning ski resorts. A little bit of golf course work as well, but for them I was responsible for exactly where you would put a ski run on a mountain. So Blackcomb Mountain, for example, was one that EcoSign designed, and this company had a lot of work in Japan way back when their economy was booming, and so I spent a lot of time over there as a result of that, working on planning ski areas in that country.
How did you get that opportunity?
That kind of came about circuitously, I guess. I was working as a professional ski patrol on Whistler Mountain, And one day the president of EcoSign was bringing the president of the third largest ski area in Japan up to Whistler to show him around. EcoSign was doing an expansion plan for this huge area in Japan. And I was chosen to guide them around the mountain to kind of make sure these guys were safe as the two presidents were kind of comparing notes on Whistler, and Zao was the name of the mountain. And just on a whim, when we were having lunch that day, I said to the president of Zao, geez, if I ever wanted to go to Japan, do you think I could get a job as a ski patroller over there? He said, sure, just let me know when you want to come. And so a couple of years later, I let him know, and he invited me over. And when I was there, I wrote some reports on how they could improve their ski patrol, because the Whistler patrol, they use pretty sharp pencils when they were doing their budgets, but they were also known as kind of pioneers in avalanche control and safety overall in the mountain, excellent medical performance and attention to the clients on the hill. These reports found their way, well, actually, after the reports on the patrol, the general manager of the Zao Ski Resort read them. He passed them on to some of the other departments, who asked me to work with them. I really didn't know too much about ski instructing or snow grooming or what lifties do, but just based on my experience in Whistler, I was able to offer them a couple of things where they might be able to improve in those areas too. And the president of EcoSign read those reports and asked me to come and work for him.
Holy.
Reluctant to go there and do that job at first because it involved wearing a suit and tie, but then I found myself in a position where I could use the money, so I took the job and did it for 4 years.
Right. Well, that's a way to bypass the old resume way.
Yeah, wow. Indeed. Yeah.
That's great.
It's through experience. I think that helps tell lots of people, though.
Maybe if you decide to take that extra step and write that report, but I don't know many people who would have done that.
Yeah, well, I guess there's always a little serendipity involved too, mm-hmm. along life's highway. It's a curvy one, as everybody knows.
Yeah. Do you feel like wearing that suit, the tie got a little tight around the neck? Did that kind of change your career path?
Yeah, well, like most people I've worked with over the years in the guiding world, the office life just wasn't for them. There's absolutely nothing wrong with office life. We need and know and love office workers, but it just really wasn't for me. And many of my colleagues at work kind of feel the same way. They would rather be outdoors in freezing rain with cold hands and feet than they would be in a nice warm office with a tight tie wrapped around their neck.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, from the guide pool that you had the chance to work with, would you say that the majority of them had tried the more corporate path?
Yeah. I think most of them probably went straight to the outdoors because they just knew, but a few, yeah, were disenchanted with their career path towards being a lawyer or an engineer. Some of the guides that I have worked with actually are engineers or are geologists, so many of them have other professions that they do in the summer or in the opposite season. But yeah, I think most guide types kind of know that they're better suited to the outdoors than they are to the indoors.
Right. Well, that's a good thing to know early on.
Yeah.
How did you know? Because it sounds like that job was kind of a bit of a blip in the grander scheme of Neil Brown's life in the outdoors.
I don't know if it was as organic as it seems with me. You know, one thing that appealed as the thoughts are rolling through my head here to me is the fact that guiding was primarily seasonal work. So there was always a light at the end of the tunnel for me from an early stage in life, I realized that I wasn't cut out to go to the same factory or same office every day for the next 30 years. And when the seasonal work ended, then you had to find something else to do. But there was always an end to it. So just about the time you got fed up with it, with any job after doing it for 4 or 5 months straight every day, it would end and a new season would begin and you could take a little bit of time off before going into the next season.
That's nice. You had a little shoulder season time there. That's good. Do you have a favorite season?
These days I like summers better.
Right.
I've had lots of winter time. But I still love winter too.
I love
the fact that here in Canada, we get to experience a full gauntlet of the changing seasons. It's so remarkable to see the leaves growing in the spring and turning color in the fall and everything in between. I mean, it's just fabulous. Again, you can't get bored like you could if you lived on the equator where the weather was the same every day and the temperature was the same every day. Here, it's kind of wake up and look out the window and see what you're getting and act accordingly.
Ain't that the truth?
Play accordingly.
We are blessed with that kind of climate here. So what do you do in the summer nowadays if you're not raft guiding anymore?
I really like mountain biking and hiking. I like spending time on lakes. I guess mountain biking would be my primary activity. It helps me stay in shape and still get your downhill gravity thrills, get your exercise going uphill. So, yeah.
Did you ever think about mountain bike guiding, or have you ever done that?
I have done that too, yeah, in the past. The thing about being a mountain bike guide is generally you have to be better than the people that you ride with. And as I got older, the younger guys could certainly outride me. So that kind of fell by the wayside a couple of decades ago. But yeah, did my time doing that too.
What haven't you done? Have you been a climbing guide?
Not been a climbing guide.
Okay, but you've climbed recreationally. Lots of climbing.
Yeah.
Why wasn't that really something that you decided to pursue?
I don't know. I never was super comfortable with it. I did enjoy the risk, but I wasn't as comfortable as I could have been to want to just continue doing that every day of my life. And, you know, a lot of the guides I've worked with are very avid climbers and just can't get enough of it. And so I have climbed many places around the world with those kind of people, but just wasn't my main thing.
Right. So have you gone on trips specifically to go climbing?
I have done that, yeah.
Where have you gone?
I've gone climbing in Japan, in Thailand, in the States, and in Canada. I guess that's about it for me. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yosemite was pretty cool.
Right.
Several different places in the States. They have some great climbing down there.
I've heard. Have you been to Smith Rock before?
I have, yeah. Been to Smith Rocks and Elephant Rocks and Red Rocks. Yeah, there's lots of rocks.
Holy, lots of rocks to be climbed out there.
Yeah.
No doubt. So, I guess going back a little bit here, did you know when you were kind of, I guess, my age, that you wanted to be a guide, or did it happen?
No, I didn't know then. It just kind of happened. I shouldn't say this on a university radio program, but I didn't finish university. I had a couple of starts and stalls and got a couple of years in, but I kept getting drawn back to the mountains. By then I was living in British Columbia, going to school out here. I don't think I mentioned this before, but I was born in Montreal and my folks moved to Peterborough, Ontario when I was about 3 years old. So I went to high school there and then post-secondary out here in BC. But I kept getting drawn up to this new ski town called Whistler.
Yeah.
And one thing just kind of led to another. I didn't specifically set out to be a guide or no, I wanted to be a guide, but I the first winter I was here, I got a job driving a snowplow and had weekends off, so I would go skiing every weekend. And I noticed after a few weeks that there were these people with red jackets on that I was told were the ski patrol, the professional ski patrol who got paid to go skiing. So I decided I would like to do that job and took an avalanche course and applied for the job. And I think it was a little easier to get on the patrol back in those days than it is now. But you did have to have first aid and a little bit of avalanche knowledge. And so I got that job, and now I was being paid to ski. And then I think we've discussed it a bit already. One thing kind of led to another. Mm-hmm. And I was just getting paid to do a higher level of skiing
ultimately. Nice. That's great. What was Whistler like when you arrived?
It was a pretty small town. You know, you pretty much knew everybody that was passing you in the opposite direction in a car. So if you drove from one end of the valley, the 12 kilometers or whatever it is, you might see half a dozen cars and you would know the people driving six or seven of them. You'd see people's dogs on the side of the road sometime that you recognize the dog and that it needed to get from Alpine Meadows back down to Creekside. So you put the dog in the car and take it back to the owner. It was a much smaller town. The nearest police station was in Squamish. The nearest grocery store was in Squamish. The nearest liquor store was in Squamish. So we did go back and forth to Squamish quite a bit in those days. And there wasn't a whole lot of entertainment here then. There was no village where the village is now. It used to be the place where we took our old refrigerators and sofas and threw them out because that was the town dump. But it is now the internationally famous village of Whistler.
Crazy. So you saw the boom.
Things have changed, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's been a pretty rapid growth. I think the skiing has been going on here for about 57 years. Before that, it was kind of a sleepy summer fishing destination. And a few hardy mountaineers used to come up here way back when, too.
Right. And while you saw this development, did you ever feel like maybe you wanted to seek out another smaller town? Or was it always Whistler for you?
No, I think it was always Whistler for me. Still, I think it always will be Whistler for me. It's just there's, you have an overabundance of clean air and clean water here and plenty of employment opportunities so you can feed and shelter yourself, although the shelter part's gotten a lot more expensive over the years. And so everything after that, once you've got clean air and water and, you know, a bed to sleep in, there's just so many things to do here and everything is a bonus. You never get bored if you love the outdoors.
So you think it's going to be home forever?
When I look around, I know and love these mountains, and I also love to travel. I mean, this has been a good travel year for me being retired now. I spent 3.5 weeks down in Chile and Argentina in the mountains down there in the early spring when the weather was warm and beautiful there. It was their autumn. And then more recently this fall, September and October, I spent some time in mountainous countries in Europe, going around to various resorts and mountain biking and hiking, and just got back from a month in Mexico. So yeah, life is pretty good as a retired guide. And, you know, I can say, because we're kind of talking about guiding here mainly, that it's not for everybody. We all know that. It takes a certain type of person and love of the outdoors and of people and showing them the outdoors in a safe and responsible manner. But you'll never get to be financially wealthy if that's the course in life you decide to pursue. I don't really know any rich guides. Guides do guide a lot of rich people, but in terms of quality of life, I think that we're some of the wealthiest people on earth, and I know the people I've had the great pleasure of working with over the years are a salt of the earth type of people who will look after you with their own lives, and I think that's another part of guiding if you get into it at a higher level, is you're just going to meet really high quality people that have high quality lives. Right. None of them rich, all driving old pickup trucks, but that's okay.
That's okay. Because
they're very wealthy.
Well, that is a fantastic life you have led now.
I feel very lucky. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of a bit of a closing remarks moment, but do you have anything you want to add? Maybe for people who are thinking of getting into the guiding industry or the mechanized guiding industry more specifically?
Yeah, I would say just, the not necessarily mechanized. A ski touring guide is a pretty good way to go to, or big mountain guide, taking clients to the Himalayas, wherever, South America, is just, I guess I could close by saying it's a good life. And if you enjoy the outdoors, then get out there and spend lots of time there, because the more time you spend outside having adventures, then the more experience you're going to get, and the better you'll be at it.
Ain't that the truth?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you for your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
I think you'll be the first episode of 2024.
Oh, that's exciting for me. Right on.
Yeah.
Cool.
Starting it off with the bar nice and high.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but once again, I appreciate your time, Jade, and thanks for having me here in the studio. And we'll look forward to your continuing episodes.
Thanks.
I'll be tuning in.
All right.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Kalalalelum is an urban indigenous health and wellness cooperative in Vancouver's downtown east side. Taking a decolonized approach to healthcare, Kalalalelum aims to partner indigenous elders with physicians and allied health professionals to provide culturally informed physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual care to our community members. You can join us in helping to decolonize healthcare and supporting members of the downtown east side by sharing our story or providing single, monthly, or annual donations. Head over to our website, kalalalelum.ca, or Instagram at kilalalelum to learn more or donate.
In the beginning, there was thumb.
Something strange and funky condensing out of the primordial ooze. Then, underground house parties and backyard raves. Stuff of legends still whispered about in Los Angeles. And now, the space barn blasts off, and Thumpasaurus is ready to engage a new frontier in the Thumpiverse. Don't miss Thumpasaurus live at the Biltmore Cabaret, January 18th, presented by MRG Live. Head to admitone.com to get your tickets now.
Something new. what you said. Cause you know it would be okay, to let it be and be one day only a memory. But I still hold on because of you. I am the one talking to you. When I look at the stars, I see you shining. I hear you singing our last song. Cause you knew it would be a way for something new. That's what you said. Cause you knew it would be okay to let it be and be one day only a memory. Ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da. Trust in when it won't go.